of the Cruciatus Curse, if that were the only way to stop Voldemort permanently. It would be justice. Balance. It would show that the Joker's life wasn't worth more than his meanest henchman. All Harry needed to do was cast the Patronus charm, send it to Alistair Moody, and tell him to come here. Well, no. It was a pretty good guess the Patronus charm wouldn't work if it was cast with that intent. Maybe just resolve to tell Moody that and use his time-turner once he was out of range of Voldemort's wards. And then Voldemort could be crucioed into permanent insanity. It wasn't even the least merciful fate. That would have been throwing Voldemort's wand into the pit at Azkaban, if the wand stayed connected to Voldemort's life and magic no matter where his ghost tried to flee. Harry turned to face where Voldemort lay. He walked forward and continued to control his breathing, ignoring the burning feeling in his throat. Some part of him knew that Voldemort was also Professor Quirrell, even though his body now was different. Even though the shift of personality had been perfect, and that meant that Professor Quirrell had been just another mask. Though Voldemort hadn't planned to kill Harry painfully, hadn't thought to strike Harry with his followers Cruciatus when Harry was being annoying before, that meant something when your opponent was Voldemort. Maybe he had had some remaining shred of fellow feeling for the other Tom Riddle after all. It would be wrong to take that into account, wouldn't it? Harry looked back up at the stars. Here, below the atmosphere, the stars twinkled. They were embedded in the false dome of the night sky, stretched out across the wash of the Milky Way that glowed like a long ribbon, as if they were all close enough that you could fly up to them on a broomstick and touch them. What would they want him to do now at this juncture? The children's children's children. The answer to that also felt obvious, if it wasn't just the part of Harry that still cared about Professor Quirrell doing the real talking. Harry had needed to do the thing he'd done. It had prevented greater evils. Harry couldn't have stopped Voldemort if the Death Eaters had fired first, but that thing Harry had done wasn't something that could be balanced by a not-necessary tragedy happening to one more sentient being, even if that being was Voldemort. It would just be one more element of the sorrows of ancient Earth so long ago. The past was past. You did what you had to do, and you didn't do one scrap of harm more than that. Not even to balance things out and make it all symmetrical. The children's children's children wouldn't want Voldemort to die, even if his minions had. They wouldn't want Voldemort to hurt, if it didn't accomplish anything compared to him not hurting. Harry breathed deeply and let go of, not his hate, not quite his hate. He hadn't been able to hate his creator, even at the very end. But even so, Harry let go of something, of the sense that he ought to hate Voldemort, that it was a hate he was obligated to feel for the endless list of crimes that Voldemort had committed for no good reason, not even his own happiness. "It's all right," the stars whispered down at him. "It's all right not to hate him. It doesn't make you a bad person." In the end, there was only one option he would take, and since Harry already knew that, there was no point agonizing about it. Whether it was the best option, only time would tell. Harry breathed deeply, building up the magic inside himself. The spell he was going to cast didn't need to be precise, but it was still one of the most powerful spells he'd mastered. Harry thought again of how unjust it was that Voldemort could not die with his followers, felt the slight trace of coldness in his blood that came with thoughts of ruthlessness. And then Harry let it go, let it all drain away beneath the starlight, because his dark side had never been anything except an inherent pattern of cognition, just one more bad habit of thinking to break. Instead, Harry looked at Hermione's breathing form atop the altar and let the tears finally start from his eyes. What would become of Hermione now? What path she would choose after this, Harry couldn't guess, but she would be there to have a choice. Their friendship wouldn't have destroyed her existence. He hadn't realized how shaky his hope had been until he'd noticed how surprised he'd been after the hope had come true. Sometimes things did go better than expected. Harry took that thought, too, and put it into the magic he was building. The power he was storing up was vibrating in him, like his whole body was part of his wand. Either Harry's eyes were blurring, or there was a luminous white quiver running over the holly. And Harry thought the shape of the spell he would cast. He didn't have much fine control, but the pattern he needed was simple. It just needed to include
everything. Forget everything, Tom Riddle. Professor Quirrell, forget your whole life. Forget your entire episodic memory. Forget the disappointment and the bitterness and the wrong decisions. Forget Voldemort.
And at the last moment before Harry cast the spell, he had one final thought. A note of grace.
But if you ever had any truly happy memories, not hurting people or laughing at their pain, but the warm feeling of helping someone or being helped, there won't be many. Maybe just when you were a child. But if you had any truly happy memories, then keep only those.
Something bright in him unfolded at the decision, knowing he had made the right choice, and Harry pushed that too into his wand.
Obliviate!
And it all poured out of Harry into the spell. Harry fell over on his side, dropping his wand, gritted screams coming from his throat, his hands going helplessly to his scar, even as the sudden blast of pain in his head began to fade. Only dimly did his eyes see that the air was filled with glowing snowflakes, drifting motes of silver light like tiny specks of Patronus charm. Only a moment the silver light lasted, and then it was gone. Professor Quirrell was gone. Nothing left but a remnant. And that spirit, what remained of it, wouldn't be so different now from Harry's own. The prophecy was complete. They had each remade the other in their own image. Harry started sobbing then, from where he was curled up in the dirt. He cried for a while. And then, eventually, Harry staggered to his feet and picked up his wand again, because this day's work wasn't quite done. Harry laid his wand directly on Voldemort's wrist stump. It made his scar throb with an ongoing pain, but neither of them exploded. And Harry began a transfiguration. Slowly, though faster than Harry had been able to transfigure Hermione's body last time, the stunned form of the Snake Man changed, reshaped itself. As the transfiguration progressed, especially as the Snake Man's head began to turn glassy and shrunken, the pain in Harry's scar faded. It would be a spell to maintain whether Harry was waking or sleeping. And later, when Harry was older and more powerful, and maybe had some help, he would untransfigure the mind-wiped Tom Riddle and heal his body with the power of the stone. After future Harry had figured out what to do with an almost completely amnesiac wizard who still had some bad habits of thought and some highly negative emotional patterns. A dark side, as it were. Plus, a great deal of declarative and procedural knowledge about powerful magic. Harry had tried his best not to obliviate that part because he might need it someday. And, meanwhile, just like magic hadn't defined a transfigured unicorn as dead for purposes of setting off wards, Voldemort's Horcruxes wouldn't define a transfigured Voldemort as dead and try to bring him back. That was the hope, anyway. Harry's scar twinged one last time when the steel ring went on his pinky finger, holding the tiny green emerald in contact with his skin. Then his scar subsided and did not hurt again. An upthrust rock served Harry for a chair when he staggered over it and sat down motionless, resting after a fashion, shoving back the exhaustion that threatened the corners of his mind. It was not done. There was more to do. Harry took another deep breath, still inhaling through his mouth, said, "Lumos!" and looked around the graveyard. Black robes and severed skull masks surrounded by pools of blood. Hermione Granger, asleep on an altar. Voldemort's empty robes and bloody hands lying where the Dark Lord had fallen. Quirinus Quirrell, with his shredded robes, fallen in a heap where the killing curse had stricken him. Harry imagined someone else looking at this scene, trying to understand it, and shook his head, because that wouldn't do. It wouldn't do at all. Then Harry shoved himself up from his rock, grimacing as his mind, if not body, protested. He hadn't been bloodied or beaten much today, but somehow Harry's body was managing to feel like all the stress had hit it directly. Harry staggered over toward where Voldemort had fallen and picked up Voldemort's left hand from where it lay upon the ground. Even in just the left hand, you could see the faint trace of snake scales. It was very distinctively Voldemort. That was good. Harry went on to the altar where the sleeping Hermione lay, and gently placed the detached hand around Hermione's neck, carefully moving the fingers to clutch at her throat. It was hard to do. Hermione seemed so peaceful and innocent when she was sleeping, and Voldemort's severed hand seemed so ugly. Harry bluntly overrode whatever part of his mind was thinking that, since it made no sense in context. A few weak severing charms served to mess up the almost perfectly fine cut the nanofibers had made, which was critical. It would not do to have the hand stump look like the neck stumps. The multiple defindos scattered small bits of Voldemort wrist all over Hermione's shirt, which, Harry had to remind himself, was also part of the plan. Harry repeated this with the right hand, arranging it symmetrically with the left. Harry used Inflammare to singe Voldemort's robes where they lay, and then arranged the singed clothing around Hermione. Voldemort's gun and his wand went into Harry's pouch, Harry placed the Stone of Permanency in an ordinary pocket. He wasn't sure what the stone might do to his pouch. The heap of things from inside Quirrell's robe, also near the altar, yielded the wand that the defense professor had used when he was being Quirrell. Harry went to where Quirrell lay and straightened out the body as best he could, and put Quirrell's wand into his hand. Tears predictably came to Harry's eyes, and Harry wiped them away on his sleeve. Harry took another deep breath, still inhaling through his mouth, said,
"Lumos!"
again, and once more looked around the graveyard. Black robes, severed skull masks, and Hermione Granger lying on an altar with Voldemort's severed hands clutched around her throat, and Voldemort's singed clothing scattered around her. Quirinus Quirrell lay dead with his clothes torn and shredded, his wand in his right hand. That would do. There remained the problem of calling attention to it. Harry was very nearly out of magic at this point, but he still had enough left to transfigure a leaf into the deflated form of a 3-meter weather balloon. Harry's pouch produced a bottle of oxyacetylene and a stick of dynamite and a spool of fuse cord. Be prepared, that's the Boy Scouts' marching song. Be prepared for a life that includes mountain trolls and who knows what else. Harry inflated the weather balloon with the oxyacetylene. That would produce a very sharp overpressure when it detonated, maybe as loud as a sonic boom. He attached the stick of dynamite. It was overkill for detonation, but it would do. He attached a 60-second fuse to the stick of dynamite, but did not light it yet. Harry put on his cloak of invisibility, that had been among the piles by the sacrificial altar. He obtained his broomstick from his pouch and mounted it. Harry cast a quieting charm around Hermione Granger. It wouldn't stop all the noise, not even close. It wasn't like she'd be permanently hurt if her eardrums burst, but it still seemed polite. And then, that was it. The quieting charm had done it. Harry was drained of magic for at least the next hour. Harry mounted the broomstick, slowly rising into the air, lifting the weather balloon filled with oxyacetylene with him. The castle Hogwarts came into view, distantly gleaming in the moonlight a few kilometers away as Harry rose above the trees. And Harry did his best to figure the distance and the angle as it would be seen from Hogwarts. When he had risen high above the forest, Harry used a lighter to ignite the fuse on the dynamite attached to the weather balloon full of oxyacetylene. Then Harry spun the broomstick and darted away, though not directly toward the castle. That might take him too close to the route past Harry and Professor Quirrell had traversed. It wouldn't do to have the professor sense another Harry. Harry felt a leaden stab of sadness, and refused it.
31, 1,000, 32, 1,000... 33, 1,000.
When Harry reached 40, not wanting to take chances with his own eardrums, he glanced at his wristwatch, noting the exact time, and spun his time-turner once. Chapter 116. Aftermath. Something to Protect. Part 0. At first, Anna had been gratified to see the final Quidditch Cup go on so long. As a Gryffindor, she was a bystander at the House Cup thing. It wasn't like Gryffindor ever won. In contrast, last year's World Cup of Quidditch, to which her family had bought some very expensive tickets, had been over in 10 minutes, which was awful. Modern Quidditch games had become too short. The snitch caught much too quickly. It was a widely talked problem among aficionados. Broomstick enchantments had advanced, while the snitch stayed the same regulation speed, with the result that Quidditch games had become shorter and shorter. At professional levels, the sport of Quidditch had been reduced to a contest of who had the deepest pockets for their Seeker's experimental racing broom, and the rest of the players might as well have been watching from the stands. Everyone knew something had to be done. The situation had been getting worse for centuries, and now it was intolerable. But the International Confederation of Wizards Quidditch Committee was mired in all the usual acrimony of the ICW, screaming disputes between Germans and Bulgarians, and somehow nobody could agree on exactly how to fix the rules. To Anna, the correct course seemed obvious. Just make the snitch fast enough to restore the 4-hour or 5-hour games of the early 19th century and the golden age of Quidditch. Except the Belgians thought the duration of a professional game should be 2 hours, like in La Belle Époque, when Belgium had dominated Quidditch, and the lunatic Italians wanted to go back to the week-long Quidditch games of the 14th century, and Britain's even crazier blood purists kept on talking up the occasional day-long Quidditch match as proof that broomsticks couldn't really have improved since everything was better in the old days, which was not how the Interdict of Merlin worked. She was 100% on the side of Harry Potter, that it was time for Hogwarts to give up on these gibbering slowpokes and just change the rules, starting here and now. But not by eliminating the snitch. That was going all the way back to 11th century Quidditch. It didn't matter if Headmistress Hufflepuff had first introduced the innovation because one of her students had wanted to play the game but not been suited to the usual roles. Snitches had caught on internationally because it was more exciting when the game could always end in the next minute. Anna had been arguing this viewpoint at the top of her lungs for the last 30 minutes, quite forgetting to pay attention to the game. Thanks to a lucky coincidence of seating, she'd been near the boy who lived and his sign, and hence she'd managed to stake out her position right from the start. She was aware, in the back of her mind, that if the Quidditch rules really did change, starting here and now, then this was the most important thing she'd ever do. She could almost feel the pressure of time twisting around her as though the fate of Quidditch itself were being settled this very day, and she was standing close to the centre of it. Though she hadn't gotten high enough scores in divination to actually sense anything like that, of course. She hardly noticed when at one point the boy who lived stood up to go to the bathroom. The boy who lived did catch her eye when he trudged back. Harry Potter looked a bit tired and wobbly, though his uniform appeared as trim as if he'd just changed into a new one. She noticed, half an hour later on, when Harry Potter seemed to sway a bit and then hunch over, his hands going to cover up his forehead. It looked like he was prodding at his forehead scar. The thought made her slightly worried. Everyone knew there was something going on with Harry Potter, and if Potter's scar was hurting him, then it was possible that a sealed horror was about to burst out of his forehead and eat everyone. She dismissed that thought, though, and continued to explain Quidditch facts to the historically ignorant at the top of her lungs. She definitely noticed when Harry Potter stood up, his hands still on his forehead, and dropped his hands to reveal that his famous lightning bolt scar was now blazing red and inflamed. It was bleeding, with blood dripping down Potter's nose. She stopped talking mid-sentence. Other people turned to look at what she was staring at.
"Professor
McGonagall?
Harry said in a wavering voice. There were tears in the corners of his eyes, which shocked her. The boy who lived didn't seem like the sort of person who would burst into tears. Harry Potter raised his voice further, as though it were hard for him to speak.
Professor McGonagall?
Professor McGonagall turned away from where she was arguing with the Hufflepuff Quidditch team. The head of Gryffindor's eyes widened in shock, and then she was moving people out of her way, almost running.
Harry!
She said.
Your scar!
Silence was spreading in a widening circle.
I think,
Harry said, his voice still wavering but louder.
I think he's back. I think I'm seeing through Voldemort's mind.
Anna took a step back at you-know-who's name and nearly fell over a bleacher. An older boy standing next to her gave a cry of dismay, and then the boy who lived shrieked even louder.
He's killing them!
Screamed Harry Potter. Half the Quidditch stadium turned to look at him.
The ritual!
Cried Harry Potter.
Blood of his servants! The blood! The life! He summoned them! He took their heads! Their blood! The life! To renew his own! The Dark Lord rises! Voldemort is returned!
Madam Hooch blew a shrill whistle, and the Quidditch brooms that hadn't already stopped in mid-air began to slow. For herself, she wasn't sure if this was a joke. If it was, the boy who lived or not, he was in more trouble than she could even imagine. Professor McGonagall raised her wand into position for a quieting charm, and Harry caught her hand.
Wait!
Harry Potter gasped, his voice lower, but still loud enough that she and the people near her could hear clearly.
He can be stopped! I see his mind! His mistake! He can be stopped now! The way is still open! She's following him! She who Voldemort slew!
Harry's voice rose further as Anna's own mouth fell open in sudden confusion.
Return! 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 Revive and stop him! Stop him, Hermione!
And then Harry Potter fell silent. He looked around him at the people staring at him. She'd just about decided that this had to be all a prank in unbelievably poor taste, when a distant but sharp crack filled the air. Harry Potter swayed and fell to his knees, even as her heart jumped into her throat. An explosion of excited babble rose around them. She could still hear the words from Harry Potter's mouth as Professor McGonagall knelt next to him.
It worked!
Harry Potter gasped aloud.
She got him! He's gone!
What?
Cried Professor McGonagall, then glanced around.
Quiet! Quiet, all of you! Harry, what happened?
Harry Potter was speaking rapidly but loudly.
Voldemort tried to revive. He summoned Death Eaters, and he killed them, stole their blood and life. Hermione's body was there. I don't know why. Maybe Voldemort was planning to use it for something. Voldemort came back. He resurrected himself, but Hermione followed him back, and she destroyed him. He's gone. It's over. It happened in a graveyard near Hogwarts. It's...
Harry Potter rose to his feet, still swaying.
I think it's in that direction.
Harry Potter pointed in the rough direction the crack had come from.
I'm not sure how far. The sound from there took 20 seconds to get here, so maybe 2 minutes on a broomstick.
With a motion so smooth it looked unconscious, Professor McGonagall shifted into a stance and said,
"Expecto patronum!"
She addressed the glowing cat that then appeared.
"Go tell Albus. Tell him he must come at once."
"Dumbledore's gone," cried Harry. "The headmaster's gone, Professor McGonagall. The Dark Lord trapped him. He reversed some kind of trap the headmaster planned, and Dumbledore was caught outside time. He's gone."
The horrified babble around them rose in pitch.
"Go to Albus,"
Professor McGonagall said to her patronus. The moonlit cat only looked at McGonagall sadly, and Anna sucked in her breath in sudden horror, feeling like someone had punched her in the stomach. It was real. It was all real. This wasn't a joke.
"Professor McGonagall, Hermione's alive!"
Harry Potter raised his voice again.
"She's really alive and not an inferior or anything, and she's still there in the graveyard."
"A broomstick!"
Professor McGonagall shouted. She turned to the players hovering motionless over the Quidditch field.
"I need a broomstick, now!"
Despite everything, Anna raised a hand in mute protest, then caught herself, even as the Ravenclaw and Slytherin seekers came zooming over, with excellent strategic sense, since they weren't actually doing anything. Harry Potter was already retrieving another broomstick from his pouch, a multi-person one. Professor McGonagall saw this and nodded firmly.
"You stay here, Mr. Potter, unless there's some excellent reason you must be there. I will go at once."
"You mustn't!"
squeaked Professor Flitwick, who'd shoved his tiny way through the crowd, occasionally running under someone's legs. His eyes were wide. He looked as though he wanted to faint.
"You have to stay at Hogwarts, Minerva. You're the..."
Professor Flitwick seemed to be having trouble speaking. Professor McGonagall spun around to face Professor Flitwick and then stopped, blood draining from her face. Then she seized the broomstick from Harry Potter's hand and presented it to the tiny half-goblin professor.
"Filius,"
she said crisply. All the incipient panic had disappeared from her voice. She now spoke in her crisp Scottish accent as though addressing lessons on Monday.
"Look for the graveyard of which Mr. Potter spoke. Find Miss Granger. Apparate her to St. Mungo's, and then stay by her."
"I think,"
Harry Potter said hoarsely,
"I think Transfiguration might have been used in combat there. Professor Quirrell tried to fight Voldemort. Take precautions."
Phileas Flitwick nodded, without halting in getting on the broomstick.
"Professor Quirrell's dead!"
wailed Harry Potter. The anguish in his voice carried clearly.
"He's dead! The Dark Lord killed him. His body..."
Harry Potter choked up.
"It's there, in the graveyard."
She stumbled back again, feeling it like another punch in her gut. Professor Quirrell had been one of her favorite professors ever. He'd made her rethink everything she'd believed about Slytherin. She'd known in some distant way that he was probably going to die very soon. But to hear that he was really, truly, dead. The boy who lived sat down on the bench, as if his legs couldn't support him any more. Professor McGonagall turned to the crowd, touching her wand to her throat.
"Quidditch is over!"
Her amplified voice boomed out.
"Go back to your dormitories!"
"Don't!"
screamed Harry Potter. Professor McGonagall turned to look at him. Tears were leaking down the boy who lived's cheeks. He looked like the interruption had surprised himself as much as it had surprised anyone else.
"It was Professor Quirrell's last plot,"
Harry Potter said, his voice breaking. The boy who lived looked at the Quidditch players who had now flown to nearby, as though speaking directly to them.
"His last plot."
Harry Potter was floated off by Professor McGonagall to the infirmary. The other professors ran off to oversee who knew what, leaving only Professors Sinestra and Hooch behind. At the stadium, rumours ran wild. Anna repeated everything she could remember hearing as best she could. Something had happened to Dumbledore. Some Death Eaters had been summoned and killed. No, Harry Potter hadn't said which ones. Professor Quirrell had gone out to face the Dark Lord and died for it. You know who had returned and died again. Professor Quirrell was dead. He was dead. In time, most of the students wandered off back to their dormitories, to sleep if they could. Anna stayed in the stadium and watched the rest of the game, ignoring her body's need for sleep and her eyes that often blurred with tears. The Ravenclaw team put up a valiant fight, but there was no Quidditch team anywhere that could have defeated the Slytherins that day. Dawn was tinging the sky when the Slytherins won their final game, the Quidditch Cup and the House Cup. Chapter 117. Something to Protect. Minerva McGonagall. The morning after had come, and all the students had gathered silently around the four tables of Hogwarts, Harry, James, Potter, Evans, Varys among them. He had collapsed in exhaustion last night and been awoken in the infirmary next morning, still muzzy, with the Philosopher's Stone underneath his left sock. The head table looked like a plague had swept it. Dumbledore's throne was gone from the head table, without replacement, leaving the centre of the head table empty. Severus Snape was sitting in a floating seat, the magical equivalent of a wheelchair. Professor Sprout was missing. According to what Harry had been told last night, a court legilimens would examine her to see if any further compulsions remained, but probably no charges would be filed. Harry had emphasized to Professor McGonagall and the Aurors as hard as he could that Professor Sprout was probably just a victim. The boy who lived had pronounced that he had seen no evidence of Sprout's intentional guilt in Voldemort's mind. Professor Flitwick was missing, presumably still staying by Hermione's side. Professor Sinestra was missing, and Harry didn't know why or where. The numbness that surrounded Harry's mind was like a mylar blanket, protective, if not comforting. There were scenes in his mind of black robes falling and blood spilling, appearing for an instant before being shoved back. He'd process it later, not now. Some other time would be better. Future Harry would have a comparative advantage at coping. Somewhere inside Harry was the fear that it wouldn't hurt, that there would be no price to be paid. But that fear also could be put off into the future. No breakfast had appeared on the tables. The students sitting near Harry were waiting in frightened silence. Owls had been prohibited from entering or leaving Hogwarts since early last night. The doors of the Great Hall opened once more, and forth came Deputy Headmistress Minerva McGonagall. She wore robes of formal black, and her head was bare, denuded of its usual witch's hat. Her grey, brown-blonde hair was done up in a coiled braid, as if in preparation for a hat to be placed later. But for now, Harry saw her head bare for the first time. Minerva McGonagall came to the lectern that stood before the head table. All eyes were upon her.
"I'm afraid that I have much news,"
Minerva said. Her voice was sad, within its Scottish precision.
"And most of it is terrible. First, the reason I am the one to speak to you is that the headmaster of Hogwarts, Albus..."
Her voice stopped.
"Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore has been lost. You know who trapped him outside time, and we do not know if he ever can be brought back to us. We have lost what may have been the greatest headmaster that Hogwarts has ever had."
A satiation of horror arose across the tables. No audible gasps or moans, just the sound of many intaken breaths, most from Gryffindor, and some from Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw as well. The ill news had already been known, but now it had also been said by authority.
"Second, you know who returned briefly, but is once again dead. All that remained of him was his hands clutching around Miss Granger's throat. There is no more threat from him, or so we think."
Minerva McGonagall drew in another breath.
"Third, Professor Quirrell died with his wand in his hand, facing you-know-who. He was found not far from where you-know-who perished again, a victim of you-know-who's killing curse."
Another susurration of verified horror, now from all four tables. Minerva drew another breath.
"Last night, we also lost what may have been the greatest defence professor in the history of Hogwarts. His scholastic merits alone. Our defence professor has gone by many names, but his true name was David Munro, as he was the last of the noble and most ancient house of Munro. His second funeral, and the true one, will be held before the most ancient hall of the Wizengamot in 2 days. Yet a wake shall also be held for the defence professor of Hogwarts, for our own Professor Quirrell in this castle. That man also died a Hogwarts teacher, as nobly as a Hogwarts teacher ever did."
Harry listened in silence, shoving down the tears that again rose to his eyes. It wasn't even true, let alone unexpected, and yet hearing it still hurt. From where he sat beside, Anthony Goldstein put a comforting hand over Harry's hand, and Harry left it there.
"Fourth, one piece of exceedingly unexpected and happy news. Hermione Granger is alive and in full health, sound of body and mind. Miss Granger is being observed at St. Mungo's to see if there are any unexpected after-effects from whatever happened to her. But she appears to be doing astonishingly well, considering her previous condition."
It should have produced wild cheers from Ravenclaw and Gryffindor, if the news had come as part of any other package, or if it had been more unexpected. As it stood, Harry saw a few smiles, but they were brief. Maybe they'd jumped for joy earlier, but at the moment there was only silence. Harry understood that. He wasn't cheering either. Not right now.
Finally!
Minerva McGonagall faltered, then raised her voice.
I fear that I have the gravest possible news to share with some of our students. It seems that you know who summoned those who were once his followers, and many of them obeyed, whether from terribly misguided loyalty or out of fear for their families if they refused. A sacrifice was required, it seems, to complete you-know-whose resurrection. Or perhaps you know who blamed his former followers for his defeat. 37 bodies were found. More followers outside Azkaban than you know who was thought to have. I am afraid.
Minerva McGonagall faltered again.
I am afraid that among the deceased are the parents of many of our students.
No. No, 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 no. As though by some terrible magnet, Harry's eyes were drawn to the picture of absolute horror that was Draco Malfoy's face, even as the comforting cotton wrap around Harry's thoughts was torn away like thin tissue. How could he have not thought? How could he have not realized? Somewhere in the background, someone was already screaming, and yet the room seemed very silent.
Sheila, Flora, and Hestia Carrow lost both their parents last night. Students who've lost their fathers include Robert Jugson, Ethan Jugson, Sarah Jugson, Michael McNair, Riley and Randy Rookwood, Lily Lou, Sasher Spruch, Daniel Gibson, Jason Gross, Elise Ambrose.
Maybe Lucius realized. Maybe he was smart enough to stay away. Maybe he realized that Voldemort was the one who struck at Draco.
Theodore Knott, Vincent Crabbe, Gregory Goyle, Draco Malfoy. This concludes the list.
One student sitting at the Gryffindor table let out a single cheer and was immediately slapped by the Gryffindor witch sitting nearby, hard enough that a muggle would have lost teeth.
30 points from Gryffindor and detention for the first month of next year,
Professor McGonagall said, her voice hard enough to break stone.
Lies!
Shrieked a tall Slytherin who had risen up from that table.
Lies! Lies! The Dark Lord will return and he'll teach you all the meaning of... Mr. Jugson,
said Severus Snape's voice. It was also faltering. It didn't sound like the potions master at all. It wasn't loud, and yet the Slytherin fell silent.
Robert, the Dark Lord killed your father.
Robert Jugson let out a scream of terrific fury and turned to run out the room, and Draco Malfoy folded in on himself like a collapsing house and made sounds that nobody heard, because the babble was starting up now. Harry rose 6 inches from the bench and then stopped.
What would you say to Draco? There's nothing you can say to Draco. Oh, you can't go over there now and pretend to be his friend. You want to make it right. You want to make it better,
but you cannot make it right, and there's no way you can make right what you have done to him. What you did to Vincent, to Gregory, what you did to Theodore.
The world blurred around Harry. He barely saw Padma Patil rise up and make her way toward the Slytherin table and Draco, or Seamus heading towards Theodore. And because Harry had read his father's science fiction and fantasy collection, because he had already read this scene a dozen times over when it happened to other protagonists, there was an image in Harry's mind of Mad-Eye Moody, of the scarred man called Alistair. And Mad-Eye's image was saying, in just the same voice he'd used to speak to Albus Dumbledore in memory, that the Death Eaters had been pointing their wands at Harry, that they'd already chosen to take the Dark Mark, that they had been guilty of sins beyond reckoning and maybe beyond Harry's imagination, that they had foregone the deontological protection of good people and made themselves targetable if there was a strong reason to sacrifice them, that it had been necessary to save Harry's innocent parents from torture and Azkaban, that it had been necessary to protect the world from Voldemort, that plain old ordinary aurors and judges had to do much more morally questionable things than killing sworn and bloodied Death Eaters who were pointing wands at them in the course of carrying out ordinary justices that were less clear-cut but still necessary to society. If it were not right to do what Harry had done, if it were not right to do much more morally ambiguous things than what Harry had done, then society as human beings knew it could not exist. Nobody with common sense would blame Harry for doing it. Neville wouldn't blame him. Professor McGonagall wouldn't blame him. Dumbledore wouldn't blame him. Even Hermione would tell him it had been the right thing to do once she knew. And all of this was true. Just as it was also true that some part of Harry's mind was calculating that wiping out the blood purist political elite would make it easier and more convenient to rebuild magical Britain afterward. It hadn't been an important consideration, but it had still been calculated in those instants of rapid thought. A check on the long-term consequences to see if they rated as catastrophic, and a decision that they actually rated as pretty much okay. And that check had forgotten that Death Eaters had children at Hogwarts, or that one of them wore the face of Draco's father. It wouldn't have changed anything. It wouldn't have changed anything at all. But that was the truth of the calculation Harry's mind had performed, given only seconds to think. At least Harry could, if the Death Eaters' survivors were in any sort of financial trouble, do something about that easily enough. Transfigure gold and use the stone to make it permanent, unless making that much gold would be troublesome to the wizard economy at large, or cause objections from goblins who didn't understand market monetarist economics. Though it wasn't as though Harry didn't also have useful services to sell. Other cotton wrap was also being torn off Harry's thoughts now.
"It seems likely,"
Minerva said. Her voice was not loud, but it cut through all other sounds.
"That some of our students will also have been stripped last night of those named as their guardians. Should you end up a ward of Hogwarts, please know that I will take the responsibilities of my position with extreme seriousness. You will be extended every courtesy. Your family's vault will be managed well and truly. As best I can, they will treat every one of you as I would my own children. And I will protect you as much as I would protect my own children. No more, no less. I hope that is clear to everyone at Hogwarts.
Students nodded rapidly.
Good,
Minerva said. Her voice sank back.
Then there is one more thing that must be done.
With a sad, solemn air, Professor Sinestra emerged from a side entrance. She was wearing white robes instead of her usual brown, and instead of her customary witch's hat, she was wearing a many-tasseled square hat whose colours had faded into mostly grey. In her hands, Professor Sinestra carried the sorting hat. With the air of someone carrying out a ceremony that had not changed in centuries, Aurora Sinestra kneeled, on one knee, before Minerva McGonagall, presenting to her the sorting hat in both hands. Minerva McGonagall took the sorting hat from Professor Sinestra's hands and placed it on her own head. There was a long silence.
"Headmistress!"
"As Albus Dumbledore is not dead,"
Minerva said, her voice so low that students strained to hear it,
"but only taken from us. I accept this position in the capacity of acting headmistress only, until Dumbledore's return."
A piercing cry split the great hall, and Fawkes was there, overflying all four tables in a slow spiral arc. He passed over each of the tables, humming in his bird's voice, a hum of absolute loyalty that would outlast the death of mere physical fires. "Wait," the hum seemed to say. "Wait until his return, and be true." Fawkes circled Minerva McGonagall three times, feathered wings brushing around her as the tears began to creep down her cheeks. Then the bird flew out a window above the hall and was gone. Chapter 118. Something to Protect Professor Quirrell. The sun shone down on the Scottish green, striking sparks of reflected white from every passing dewdrop or reflective leaf that happened to position itself correctly. A clear blue sky for a funeral. Harry had declined to give the eulogy. He'd declined for the second time. Professor Flitwick had asked him about it weeks ago in May, to give Harry time to write his lines before it would become necessary to speak, and Harry had said no then too. So it fell to a sixth-year Gryffindor, Oliver Habreitia, who had the fourth highest total of Quirrell points among all the students, and who had been general of an army. The 17-year-old boy was tall and not especially handsome in solid black robes. Instead of a red tie, he was wearing a purple tie, such as Professor Quirrell had sometimes favoured. Speaking under the circumstances, ex tempore. The previous eulogies, written well in advance, had been discarded. Oliver Habreitia had a parchment in his left hand, but he wasn't looking at it at all. "Professor Quirrell was very sick," the tall boy said, his wavering voice falling into a hush of students, occasionally broken by a muffled sob. "I think if Professor Quirrell had been able to fight in the fullness of his power, you know who couldn't have beat him easily, and maybe not at all. They say that David Munro was the only person that you know who was ever afraid of in his day. But..." Oliver's voice broke. "Professor Quirrell wasn't in the fullness of his power. He was very sick. He had trouble walking by himself, and he went to face the Dark Lord alone." There was a pause then, while the students cried for a while. Oliver wiped away his tears with his sleeve, and spoke again. "We don't know exactly what happened," said Oliver. "I imagine the Dark Lord laughed at him. Maybe made fun of the Professor for challenging him when he couldn't stand up. Well, he's not laughing now, is he?" There were fierce nods from the students, all of them that Harry could see, from Gryffindor to Slytherin. "Maybe the Dark Lord knew some way of curing Professor Quirrell. You know who did come back from the dead, after all. Maybe he offered Professor Quirrell his life, if Professor Quirrell would serve him." Professor Quirrell smiled, and told the Dark Lord it was time for them to play a game called Who's the Most Dangerous Wizard in the World?
"If you don't know, don't just make stuff up."
But Harry didn't say anything. It was what Lord Voldemort might have tried. It was what Professor Quirrell might have said back.
"And they aren't telling us everything," Oliver said. "But we can guess what happened next. We all know that Hermione Granger, who was one of the Professor's best students, was killed by a troll earlier this year. It must have been the Dark Lord who made it happen, just like he framed her for the blood-cooling charm. Professor Quirrell knew the Dark Lord was behind it. He stole Miss Granger's body and preserved it. Kept it safe."
Couldn't blame him for that one.
"Then Professor Quirrell went out to face the Dark Lord. The Dark Lord killed Professor Quirrell, and Hermione Granger came back to life. They say she's alive and whole now, and maybe something more. When the Dark Lord tried to seize her, all that was left of him afterward was his burned robes and his hands around Miss Granger's throat. Just as Harry Potter was protected from the killing curse by his mother's love and sacrifice, Professor Quirrell willingly going out to face the Dark Lord alone must have called Hermione Granger's spirit back from wherever she was."
Oliver's voice was breaking.
"Not just like that,"
Harry said from the front row of seats, his own voice hoarse. He had to say something at this point before it got out of control, if it wasn't already out of control.
"David Munro was a powerful wizard, more powerful than anyone knew except him and me. I don't think you can bring someone back from the dead just by sacrificing yourself. No one should try doing it that way."
Such a beautiful story.
It should have been true.
It should have been true.
"I don't know very much about the person behind the Professor," Oliver Habrikia said, after he got himself under control again. "I know David Munro wasn't a happy man. He never could cast a Patronus charm."
Tears were gathering in Harry's eyes again.
It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. Voldemort had killed so many people.
He should have died along with his followers. He didn't deserve special treatment. But it hadn't just been Harry's weakness. It had been the Horcruxes. Voldemort couldn't have been killed outright. So Harry could admit it. He was glad. He was glad Professor Quirrell wasn't all gone.
"But I know,"
said Oliver, tears glistening on his own cheeks.
"Professor Quirrell is happy, wherever he is now."
On Harry's left hand, a tiny emerald glowed bright beneath the morning sun.
"Not heaven, not some faraway star, not a different place, but a better person. I'll show you. Some day I'll show you how to be happy."
The tall boy glanced down at a parchment he held in his other hand, the first time he'd consulted it.
"Professor Quirrell,"
Oliver said, his voice now fiercer and faster,
"was by far the best professor of battle magic that Hogwarts ever had. Salazar Slytherin couldn't have been half as good a teacher, no matter what spells he knew.
Professor Quirrell told us at the beginning of this year that what he taught us would always be our firm foundation in the arts of defence. And it will be. Forever. We'll teach it to the new students next year, no matter who we have for a professor. The older students will teach the younger ones. That's the solution to the curse on the defence position. We won't sit around waiting for authority to teach us, and we'll make sure that Professor Quirrell's teachings never die out of Hogwarts.
Harry looked at where Professor... No, Headmistress McGonagall was sitting, and saw the headmistress nodding silently, a look that was sad and stern and proud.
"They haven't let us see Miss Granger yet," Oliver said. His voice quavered. "The girl who revived. But I'll always think of the defence professor when I see her. His sacrifice lives on in her, just as his teachings live on in us."
Oliver glanced at where Harry sat, then looked down again at the parchment.
"Here's to Professor Quirrell, then. The best Slytherin that ever was. What every Slytherin should be. 3 cheers for him. Huzzah! Huzzah! Huzzah!"
No one stayed silent this time. Not a single student that Harry could see. Chapter 119. Something to Protect. Albus Dumbledore. Harry stood now before the gargoyles that guarded the headmaster's... No, the headmistress's office. He had been summoned by Professor Sinestra, told that it was an emergency, but the gates were not opening for him. Experiment had showed that the stone made one transfiguration permanent every 3 minutes and 54 seconds, irrespective of the size of the object transfigured. Just once, holding the Philosopher's Stone up to the light of Harry's most powerful flashlight in an otherwise darkened closet, Harry had thought he'd seen an array of tiny points inside the chunk of crimson glass. But Harry hadn't been able to see it again, and now suspected himself of having imagined it. The stone had no other powers that Harry could detect, nor did it respond to any attempted mental commands. Harry had given himself until noon tomorrow to figure out how to begin using the stone without it being grabbed by someone else, trying not to think about what was still happening, what had always been happening in the meanwhile. 10 minutes late, Minerva McGonagall approached, moving in a swift stride. Her arms were full of papers. She was once again wearing the sorting hat. The gargoyles, with a brief sound of grinding stone, bowed low before her.
"The new password is impermanence,"
Minerva said to the gargoyles, and they stepped aside.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Potter. I was delayed."
"Understood."
Minerva mounted the long spiral stairs, climbing instead of waiting to be carried, Harry following behind her.
"We are meeting with Amelia Burns, Director of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, with Alistair Moody, whom you've met, and with Bartimus Crouch, Director of the Department of International Magical Cooperation,"
Minerva said as she climbed.
"They are Dumbledore's heirs, as much as you or I."
How's Hermione doing?"
Harry hadn't had a chance to ask until now.
"Phileas said she seemed rather in shock, which I suppose is not surprising. She asked where you were, was told you were at a Quidditch game, asked where you really were, and refused to speak with anyone about what happened until she was allowed to talk with you. She was taken to St. Mungo's where..."
The headmistress now sounded slightly perturbed.
"A standard diagnostic charm showed Miss Granger as a healthy unicorn," in excellent physical condition, except that her mane needs combing. Charms to detect active matrix have each time detected her as being in the process of transforming into another shape. There was an unspeakable who showed up before Ophelius, removed him. He performed certain spells he probably ought not to have known, and declared that Hermione's soul was in healthy condition, but at least a mile away from her body. At that point, the senior healers gave up. She's currently alone in a cell with the rats and flies.
She's what?
I'm sorry, Mr. Potter. That's transfiguration jargon. Miss Granger is in an isolation chamber with a cage of tame rats and a box of flies that will bear offspring in a single day. Logic suggests that whatever mystery underlies her resurrection, it left behind an emanation that is causing the healer's charms to produce gibberish. But if nothing happens to the rats or to the flies' offspring, Miss Granger will be declared safe to return to Hogwarts after she wakes up again tomorrow morning.
Harry still wasn't sure at all, what Hermione would think of having been resurrected, at least under these particular circumstances. He didn't actually think Hermione would yell at him for doing it wrong. That was just Harry's brain trying to imagine her as a stereotype. Harry had been legitimately exhausted and not thinking very straight when he'd come up with that cover story, and Hermione would probably understand that part. But he couldn't imagine what Hermione would think.
I wonder how Miss Granger would feel about having also vanquished you-know-who,
Minerva said reflectively, climbing the moving stairs fast enough that Harry felt out of breath trying to keep up.
And people believing the most interesting things about her.
You mean because she's always self-identified as a normal academic genius, and now a bunch of people think of her as the girl who revived, and everyone wants to shake her hand,
Harry said.
Even though she doesn't remember doing anything to earn it, even though it was all someone else's work and other people's sacrifices, and she's getting the credit, even though she doesn't feel like she's actually done anything worthy of the way other people treat her, and she's not sure if she can ever live up to the person they imagine. Gosh, I don't know. I can't imagine what that feels like. Maybe I shouldn't have subjected her to it, but people had to be given something to believe, or heaven knows what they'd have made up. Feeling guilty about this would be stupid, I think.
The two of them reached the top of the stairs and came into the office filled with dozens of strange objects, all facing a great desk and a mighty throne behind it. Minerva's hand passed over one of those objects, the one with golden wibblers, her eyes closing briefly. Then Minerva took off the sorting hat and put it on a hat rack that held three slippers for left feet. She transformed the mighty throne into a simple cushioned chair, and the great desk into a round table around which four other chairs rose up. Harry watched it all with a strange pang in his throat. He knew, without either of them saying anything, that there should have been more ceremony for the changing of the chairs, the changing of the table. Much more ceremony for the first time the headmistress sat down in her new office. But for whatever reason, there wasn't time, and Minerva McGonagall was discarding all that for speed. Harry quietly took one of the chairs around the table, sitting at Minerva's left. Almost at once, the flue fire burned emerald and whirled out Alistair Moody, who spun around with his wand raised, taking in the whole room at a seeming glance, and then pointed his wand directly at Harry and said,
"Avada Kedavra!"
It happened so fast and took him so completely by surprise that Harry's wand wasn't even half raised by the time Alistair Moody finished the incantation.
Just checking.
Alistair said to the headmistress, whose own wand was now pointed at Alistair, her mouth open as if to say words she couldn't find.
Voldy would have tried to dodge if it'd taken over the boy's body last night. We still need to check the Granger girl, though.
Alistair Moody went to Minerva's right and sat down. Harry had thought, in that split second, to try producing a wordless silver Patronus glow from his wand, but his wand hadn't been in place to intercept in time. Not even close.
Well, if I was feeling invincible before, that does for that. What a valuable life lesson, Mr. Moody.
Then the flue fire burned green again and spat out the oldest, grimmest, toughest-looking witch Harry had ever seen, like beef jerky given human shape. The old witch did not have her wand in her hand, but she projected an air of authority that was stronger and stricter than Dumbledore's.
"This is Director Amelia Boons, Mr. Potter,"
said Headmistress McGonagall, who regained her poise.
"We're still waiting on Director Crouch."
"The corpse of Barnabas Crouch, Jr. was identified among the dead Death Eaters,"
the old witch said without preamble, even as she continued toward the chairs.
"It took us entirely by surprise, and I'm afraid Barnabas is in considerable grief about it, on both counts. He will not be with us today."
Harry kept the flinch inward. Amelia Bones sat down in a chair, sitting to Moody's own right.
"Headmistress McGonagall,"
said the elder witch, still without hesitation or delay,
"the line of Merlin Unbroken, which Dumbledore left to me in Regency, is not responding to my hand. Though Isengamot must have a chief warlock who is trustworthy at once, matters are in great flux in Britain. I must know what Dumbledore has done immediately."
"Crap," muttered Moody. His mad eye was rolling wildly.
"That's not good. Not good at all."
"Yes, well,"
said Minerva McGonagall, who looked rather apprehensive.
"I cannot say that for certain. Albus, well, he clearly had an intimation that he might not survive this war, but I do not think he was expecting Miss Granger to come back from the dead and kill Voldemort only hours later. I do not think Albus was expecting that at all. I'm not quite sure what his legacies will make of that."
Amelia Bones rose half out of her chair.
"You mean to imply that the Granger girl may have inherited the line of Merlin unbroken? This is a catastrophe. She is 12 years old, untested. Surely Albus would not be so irresponsible as to leave the line to whoever happened to defeat Voldemort without knowing who."
"Well, putting it simply,"
Minerva said. Her fingers squared the paper she'd taken with her, now lying on the desk.
"Albus did think he knew who would defeat Voldemort. There was a prophecy concerning it, a verified one, which now seems to be in abeyance. Or, I don't know, Madam Bones. I have one letter for Mr. Potter that I am to give him in the event of Albus's death or other departure, and then another letter that Albus said Mr. Potter would be able to open only after he defeated Voldemort. I'm not sure what will happen to it now. Perhaps Miss Granger will be able to open it, or perhaps it can never be opened."
"Hold up,"
Mad-Eye Moody said. He reached into his robes, drew out a long, grey, knobbed wand that Harry recognised. It was Dumbledore's wand, of a form and style not like any other wand in Hogwarts. Moody laid the wand on the table.
"Before we go any further, Albus left me an instruction or two of his own. Pick up this wand, boy."
Harry hesitated, thinking.
Albus Dumbledore sacrificed himself for me. He trusted Moody. This probably isn't a trap.
Then Harry began to reach for the wand. It leapt up and flew across the table into Harry's hand. And the moment that Harry's fingers grasped the handle, it was like he heard a song. A paean of glory and battle that resonated in his mind. A wave of white fire ran up the handle and over the wood, magnifying as it moved, bursting from the end in a tremendous spray of sparks. Through the wood beneath his fingers ran a sense of strength and constrained danger, like a leashed wolf. Harry was also receiving an impression of distinct skepticism, as if the wand had some level of awareness, and it was wondering how the hell it had ended up being held by a Hogwarts first year.
"Right," said Mad-Eye Moody into the puzzled stares. "So it wasn't Miss Granger who defeated Voldy, then? Didn't think so."
"What?"
Amelia Bones spoke the word flatly. Mad-Eye Moody gave her a respectful nod.
"Albus said this wand goes to whoever defeats its previous master. Took it off old Grindy, he did. Then Voldy defeated Albus yesterday. Do I need to spell it out, Amelia?"
Amelia Bones was staring at Harry, her mouth wide open.
That might not be right," Harry said.
He swallowed another pang of the awful guilt.
I mean, Voldemort used me as a hostage because I... I was stupid, and Dumbledore gave himself up to save me. Maybe the wand thinks that counts as my defeating Dumbledore. I did defeat Voldemort, though. Vanquished him. But I think it's better if nobody has any idea I was there.
Beep, tick, rrr, ding, boop.
"That must have taken some doing,"
Mad-Eye said. The scarred man inclined his head slowly, a gesture of profound respect.
"Don't feel too guilty about losing Albus and David and Flamel, son. No matter how stupid you were, you won in the end. All of us put together never could. Just to check, son, you and David also destroyed Voldy's Horcrux, and you're certain it was the real thing?"
Harry hesitated, weighing up the probable consequence of trust, the possible disasters of silence, and then shook his head to Moody in reply. He'd been planning to tell at least McGonagall about what was inside her skull anyway.
"Voldemort had rather a lot of Horcruxes, actually. So, instead, I obliviated most of his memories, then transfigured him into this."
Harry raised his hand and silently pointed to the emerald on his ring. Splat, boing, splat, splat. Moody said, leaning back in his chair.
"Minerva and I will be putting some alarms and enchantments on that ring of yours, son, if you don't mind, just in case you forget to sustain that transfiguration one day. And don't go hunting any other dark wizards, ever. Just live a quiet and peaceful life."
The scarred man took a handkerchief and wiped at the beads of sweat that had now appeared on his forehead.
"But, well done, lad. You and David both, may you rest in peace. This was his idea, I'm guessing. Well done, I say."
"Indeed,"
said Amelia Bones, who had now regained her composure.
"We all owe the both of you a tremendous debt of gratitude. But I say again that there is urgent business regarding the line of Merlin Unbroken."
"I believe,"
Minerva McGonagall said slowly,
"that I had best give Albus his letters to Mr. Potter right now."
At the top of her stack of papers now lay a parchment envelope and a rolled-up parchment scroll sealed with a grey ribbon. The headmistress gave Harry the parchment envelope first, and Harry opened it.
"If you are reading this, Harry Potter, then I have fallen to Voldemort, and the quest now lies in your hands. Though it may shock you to learn, this was the end that I wished in my heart would come to pass. For as I write this, it yet seems possible that Voldemort may fall by my own hand, and then in time I shall myself become the darkness you must overcome to enter fully into your power. For it was said once that you might need to raise your hand against your mentor, the one who made you, who you loved. It was said that you might be my downfall. If you are reading this, then that shall never come to pass, and I am glad of it. Even so, Harry, I would spare you this, the lonely fight against Voldemort. I write this, vowing to shelter you as long as I can, no matter the final cost to myself. But if I have failed, then know that I am glad of it, in my own selfish way. With my passing, there is none left to oppose Voldemort as an equal save you. His shadow will fall long and terrible over magical Britain, and many will suffer and die for it. That shadow will not lift until you destroy its source, until you cleanse the hearts of the darkness. How you are to do this, I do not know. If Voldemort knows not the power you bear, then neither do I. You must find that power within yourself. You must learn to wield it. You must become Voldemort's final judge. And I beg you not to make the error of showing him mercy. My wand, which I have left to you in Moody's keeping, you must not dare to wield against Voldemort. For when that wand's master is defeated, it passes to the victor in turn. When you have conquered my conqueror, then the wand will answer truly to your hand. But if you try to turn it against Voldemort before then, it will betray you for certain. Keep it out of Voldemort's grasp at all costs. I should advise you not to wield that wand at all, yet it is a device of great power, which you might need in some desperate case. But if you pick it up, you must fear its treachery at all times. In my absence, the Wizengamot will inevitably fall to Malfoy. The line of Merlin unbroken I have passed to you, with Amelia Bones as your regent, until you come of age or come into your power. But she cannot oppose Malfoy for long, not with myself gone and Voldemort returned to advise him. Soon, I think, the Ministry will fall, and Hogwarts will become the last fortress. To Minerva, I have left Hogwarts' keys, but you alone are its prince, and she will help you however she can. Alistair now leads the Order of the Phoenix. Heed his words well, both his advice and his confidences. It is one of my life's greatest regrets that I did not heed Alistair more and sooner. That you will, in the end, defeat Voldemort, I have no doubt. For that will be only the beginning of your life's destiny. Of that, too, I am certain. When you have vanquished Voldemort, when you have saved this country, then I hope you may embark upon the true meaning of your days. Hurry, then, to begin. Yours in death, or in whatever, Dumbledore. P.S. The passwords are Phoenix's price, Phoenix's fate, and Phoenix's egg, spoken within my office.
Harry folded up the parchment and put it back into the envelope, frowning thoughtfully. Then took the grey ribbon scroll from the headmistress. When the long grey wand in Harry's hand touched the ribbon, it fell away at once, and Harry unrolled the scroll and read it.
Dear Harry James Potter Evans Verus, if you are reading this, you have defeated Voldemort. Congratulations on that. I hope you had some time in which to celebrate before you opened this scroll, because the news in it is not cheerful. During the First Wizarding War, there came a time when I realized that Voldemort was winning, that he would soon hold all within his hand. In that extremity, I went into the Department of Mysteries and invoked a password which had never been spoken in the history of the line of Merlin Unbroken. Did a thing forbidden, and yet not